Hi, everyone. Last week, we had a discussion about issues like weather modification, whether it could be used against us by our own governments. And so there was this question about how much of this stuff happens, what do we know about it? And as it turns out, I've done some work. One of the fields that I work in is economics of disasters. And I recently finished editing a book in which I wrote two chapters. One is kind of a typology of all the different types of disasters, and another is a summary of weather modification activity globally. So a lot of weather modification activity is used to help people try to avert hail or increase rainfall in dry areas, things like that. But if you can use that technology for, you know, to increase rainfall for good purposes, it could be used potentially for harmful purposes or geopolitical purposes. And so what I'd like to do is just talk about really climate and weather generally for some context, and then jump into the different types of weather modification that we know about officially, and then maybe some discussion about stuff that, you know, is a little less transparent, and then we can go from there. All right, so I got involved in some of this work on climate and weather because I was teaching a modeling course, and I was trying to help students see how economic models could be integrated with climate models. And I started digging into the climate models. I'm not a climate scientist, but I realized that, you know, they're very complex, and the more complex models are, the harder it is to see the importance of different factors that affect the outcome. And so I just started looking at these issues, and that's kind of how I got started down this path. And so what I'd like to do is talk for a few minutes about weather and climate and factors that we don't always think about that affect climate and weather. And so two of those things are the solar cycle and the changing magnetic field that is occurring right now. And so I'm going to talk about some of those things first for context, and then jump into weather modification. And I think I'll probably take about 30 minutes to go through this, and then we can open it up to discussion. So the difference between weather and climate is that weather is local and climate is global. So when we talk about geoengineering, we're talking about changing the climate globally, whereas a lot of weather modification activity is designed to affect the weather locally. And so I want to make that distinction. And then we have indirect effects potentially on the weather from, you know, we hear a lot about CO2 emissions, but another factor are urban heat islands. These are just effects on localized weather or global climate that we could potentially be in, you know, a part of as you know, human activity. So, but then we also have direct efforts at changing the weather through weather modification and through geoengineering. This is a summary from chapter 2 of the book that I just had referred to, and it kind of lists all the different categories and types of natural disasters that happen. And sometimes things happen very regularly, like storm cycles, hurricanes and typhoons, and other things happen less often, like an earthquake is much less often, and then even less often. And I've highlighted an area here that a lot of people aren't familiar with, and we don't really talk about it or teach it. But we do have magnetic pole excursions that occur regularly throughout, you know, the very long history of Earth. We also have physical pole shifts, the most recent of which occurred about 12,000 years ago. And then we also have solar storms and then solar cycles that in turn, all of these things can affect the weather and the climate. So that's why I want to talk about some of this stuff up front for this broader context. First of all, this is probably the best measure of the Earth's temperature, satellite-based data. And And you can see a modest trend upward in the overall Earth's climate, or in terms of temperature. So, but it doesn't look to be an emergency, right? It's not really changing rapidly. And what we hear a lot about is CO2 emissions, and that potentially warming the climate or creating climate change. And so if you look at CO2 in the atmosphere, since we started industrializing, CO2 emissions have gone up. And I think it's fair to say that that's due to human activity largely. But if you go back further in time, you can see it's cyclical, but the CO2 emissions just recently look like they're really quite high compared to the last 800,000 years. And if you go back into the millions of years, you can see we're right here. So there is a trend upward here that we're noting. But that doesn't seem to be super highly correlated with changing global temperature. And those models are hard to, at least for me, to understand. But and then this is the estimated global temperatures over 500 million years. And you can see, you know, for much of it, we've been much warmer than we are now. Okay, so as part of that search through the climate literature, I ran into astrophysicists who study the energy coming from the sun. And Professor Zarkova is one of those, and she has published research on this. And importantly, she asserts, and I think very convincingly, that we have entered into another grand solar minimum beginning in 2020 and running for the next 30 years or so. So she expects that this will lead to a reduction in terrestrial temperature. And she maps out the 11-year cyclic variation in sunspots and energy coming from the sun, which can affect Earth's temperature and climate. But overarching, these shorter cycles are these 350 to 400-year cycles that also have a big impact, much larger impact than the shorter cycles. And so she's mapped out these cycles going back to the year 1200. The Maunder minimum, I'll talk a little bit about more, but it was a very cold period. And so she concludes one of her articles with this statement: the reduction of terrestrial temperature in the next 30 years can have important implications for different parts of the planet on growing vegetation, agriculture, food supplies, heating needs in both the northern and southern hemisphere. This global cooling during the upcoming grand solar minimum can offset three decades any signs of global warming that would require intergovernmental efforts to tackle problems of heat and food supply for the whole population of the Earth. So she thinks that if there is any anthropomorphic climate change because of CO2 emissions, et cetera, that this outweighs it. And you can see that the cycle in 1600 or so is the Maunder minimum, where it got very cold. And so you had frozen rivers such as the Thames in England, long cold winters, cold summers, sea ice expanded south in the Arctic and the Alpine, glaciers stretched into the valley farm line, even the canals in the Netherlands froze. So you can see it was very cold during this period. That maps with the sun's energy here. And then you have the Dalton minimum here, and then again here. And then the overall energy of the sun increased, and that seems to be matched with the warming that we've seen in more recent times. So I just want to provide that context that I think is important in terms of thinking about climate and weather. The other thing that's happening is that happens regularly in these very long periods is geomagnetic excursions or magnetic pole shifts. Excursions are more common. And that's when the magnetic pole actually wanders around and can and move great distances and sometimes relatively quickly. And we're having that happen right now. And when this happens, it sometimes is associated with a weakening of the geomagnetic field. And over the past 150 years, the geomagnetic field has decreased by about 10%. That makes us more vulnerable to solar flares and coronal mass ejections. And I would say that that's a significant factor, a risk factor for us because we're so technologically dependent. The last large solar flare, solar storm, occurred in 1859. It's called the Carrington event, and it damaged the US telegraph network greatly. So you can imagine being hit with one of these storms with a weaker magnetic field. It can have a big impact on these industrialized economies. And this excursion is underway, and it was moving much faster than expected. And so the GPS systems had to be updated because of that in 2019. Also, there's evidence that this changing magnetic field can influence the climate. And so since 1900, you can see that the North Pole has wandered from Northern Canada all the way to close to the geographic North Pole and appears to be continuing to move towards Russia. And I expect that to continue. And I think that our magnetic field will continue to weaken. The other thing that's happening is if you go back 40 or 50 years, we had a much more stable airstream. And now we have a wavier airstream, which partially explains why you end up with these large heat waves in the West and then cooler weather in the northern part of the United States or in Europe, for example. And so that's happening. And so I don't have the answer to this question. Some people say, well, it's because of climate change from CO2 emissions. I tend to think it may be associated with a changing magnetic field or changing solar activity. But so I would make a distinction between changes in the overall global temperature with this wavy stream where you can get more extremes in the mid-latitude areas. The other thing that most people, I think, aren't aware of is that we have had actual physical pole shifts that have occurred many, many times in Earth's history. The most recent one occurred about 12,000 years ago. The previous physical location of the North Pole used to be in Hudson Bay, Canada. And prior to that were Greenland, the Norwegians in the Norwegian Sea, and the Bering Sea pole locations. And this was kind of a hypothesis put forward by Charles Hapgood in the 60s, which didn't get a lot of traction among a lot of scientists. But Mark Carlotto, he's an electrical engineer who works for General Dynamics, and he does a lot of remote sensing and has worked on imagery for Mars. But in his spare time, he does the same for Earth, and he loves ancient sites. And the thing that he noticed about a lot of these ancient sites, you know, in most places around the world, city streets and structures are oriented north and south towards the magnetic pole. I'm facing out my window now to the north. But a lot of ancient sites are not perfectly oriented to our current North Pole, not the magnetic North Pole, but the physical North Pole. They're just off. And so what he did, and I think this is new and compelling evidence in support of Hapgood's theories, is that he mapped ancient sites to the Hudson Bay Pole almost perfectly. And so these are some examples. And then the pole before that was the Greenland Pole. So the Tower of Babel is aligned to the Greenland Pole. The Parthenon is aligned to the Greenland Pole. And that's not to say that these structures were built at that time, but they may have been built on top of earlier structures that were oriented here. And then also the Norwegian seapole. What this suggests is, is that this, you know, this physical pole location that we have now at the North Pole looks like the image here that I'm showing is here. The previous pole was in Hudson Bay, about right here. And if you look at the history of the glacial period in North America, about 12,000 years ago, we had glaciers coming all the way down to the upper Midwest of Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and then they went away. And you have the Niagara Falls, for example, massive waterway, and geologists can estimate how long that fall has been there by the erosion of the fall, and it's about 11 or 12,000 years. In the meantime, you can see over in Russia, you're far away from the Arctic Circle. It's going to be much more warmer, and over here towards Alaska and Russia here. And this is where we have flash frozen mammoths and animals, you know, that are or were so suddenly frozen that their meat, when they come, are found in the ice, their meat is still stable and good. So it suggests it was a significant, a potentially catastrophic change that occurred. Okay, so all of this context suggests that that human civilization has been around and organized for more than 7 to 10,000 years, as we're often taught in school, and that many factors affect Earth's climate over the long run and the shorter run. And human activity is potentially part of that, but I think there are these other factors that we need to put that in context with, like the solar cycles, et cetera. And we have direct efforts to control the weather and climate. And that's what I want to turn to next. So I think I've covered this already. Do we have a climate emergency? When I look at the temperatures, I don't see an emergency. When I look at the wavy jet stream, we can get more severe or extreme weather, but it's not clear to me that CO2 emissions. I think it's more likely due to the changing geomagnetic field or the solar cycle. Okay, so weather modification intervenes in localized weather events. Geoengineering is an effort potentially to alter the whole Earth's climate. There are private sector entities that do weather modification. In the United States, you can even hire a firm to do cloud seeding before a wedding if you want to try to increase your chances that you won't get rain, for example. And a lot of public sector pay for different types of weather modification. Local governments do a lot of it in the United States. A lot of this is open, we can see it, and some of it is not transparent at all. So let's talk about the history and the types of interventions, and maybe talk a little bit about effectiveness. So geoengineering is, again, affecting the whole climate. So solar radiation management is discussed. Some people think it's already happening. I think it is happening now, but it's not advertised as such. There's something called carbon capture and storage to try to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. Those are examples of geoengineering. Weather modification, the dominant form is cloud seeding for rain enhancement, increasing snowpack, reducing hail, fog dispersal, potentially reducing storm impacts and lightning. And there are other types, ultra short lasers can be used, satellite systems potentially, electrical charges and sound waves are all approaches at influencing the weather. The first cloud seeding patent was done by Bernard Vonnegut. And so the idea is to form moisture around the seeding to get that moisture to drop sooner than it otherwise would. About 20 years later, President Johnson said, it is clear that the time has come for us to move vigorously forward to explore possibilities of modifying and controlling weather in beneficial ways. So by the 1960s, this was it was quite a high level of interest. And then it kind of disappeared in terms of interest level and at least in the United States at the federal level. As far as I can tell, there's no explicit budget for weather modification. In the US, the weather modification that occurs is primarily at the local level or at states doing some work, maybe some with grant work, but anyway, so it's not clear how much we're doing today, and it's not transparent. These are just examples of a test that occurred early on. Try to reduce lightning caused wildfire through cloud seeding. Project Skywater was to learn how to manage precipitation in water deficient areas. Storm Fury experimented the use of cloud seeding approaches to modify hurricanes. At the time, it didn't appear to be very effective. At least that's what was reported. In the 70s, there were concerns about these technologies being used for military purposes, which gave rise to the UN passing the Convention on the Prohibition of Military or any other hostile environmental modification techniques. There was a broad agreement not to engage in military or other hostile use of environmental modification techniques. And so that was the agreement. But we know that the US Department of Defense used cloud seeding during the Vietnam War to try to get more rain and mud and to their advantage. And then more recently, there are several articles that talk about the Department of Defense owning the weather or operational defenses through weather control. So it seems pretty clear to me that we do have in the United States a federal program, primarily within the DOD, that operates, but we don't know how much money is spent, and we don't know who and what kind of technology is being used, or at least I don't. But there are lots of known programs. China is probably, ironically, the most open about it. They're developing an area about the size of Alaska in the Tibetan Plateau to have these huge ground-based cloud seeding. They want to add rainfall to add to the river tributaries. And that created some tension with India because they're on the other side and they're concerned about flooding. The Sun reported that China has announced plans to move rain clouds thousands of miles through an atmospheric corridor. And here, they said it was some sort of satellite, and they used it during the Beijing Olympics to try to avert rain. They used it in Beijing to increase snow. So they're very open about their efforts to influence the weather. In the United Arab Emirates, they use electrical charges via drones into clouds to try to increase rainfall. All of these countries have active cloud seeding programs or a weather modification programs. And in the United States, we have programs in these following states, California, Colorado, Idaho, Kansas, Montana, Nevada, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Texas, and Wyoming. And some of this is to enhance rainfall, some is to increase snowpack, others are to reduce hail damage, and those kinds of things. In Canada, they have programs as well. In Calgary, they have a hail suppression program. This is where it kind of comes back around to COVID. And what I want to do is play a 2-minute clip of Brian Pallister, who is the premier of Manitoba. And in this little clip, a reporter is asking about COVID policies. And the premier responds with a very strange comment. He says, I want to thank the people in charge for making that rain available. And so I just want you to listen to this. And with this context about weather modification activity, what this might mean. The other thing I'll point you to is Dane Whittington's General Geoengineering Watch website. He tries to capture the unacknowledged weather manipulation that may be occurring. And I'm going to allow maybe Catherine and others have more information on this, but it's just a, you know, sort of that less transparent approach. I try to focus on what we know for sure. And Dane is trying to get at these unacknowledged programs that could potentially be happening really all over the world. So I'll do that. And then also I have all the references cited here if you'd like to have them. So I'm going to stop sharing this and then go to the video and then we can have a discussion.
Wow. So if we're fighting this disease from, you know, from the sky, from the land, and from the sea, so to speak, there also seems to be another kind of hesitancy. And I'm speaking about treatment drugs. There's a hesitancy to talk about ivermectin. There's a hesitancy to try it, it seems. Maybe you know something more about what our health system is doing, but there's certainly news that ivermectin, I mean, Dr. Alessandro Santon, an oncologist working with a laboratory at Yale, believes that ivermectin could be very effective. He's worked with it, he's tried it, and of course, he's not the only one. It's apparently a drug that does no harm. In particular, it's not got a big risk to try it, but it has helped many, many people. Are we doing anything with that? And if not, why not?
We're pursuing domestic research that we hope can lead to better vaccine availability in the future, perhaps not during this wave, but when we need boosters in coming years, or if there's another pandemic, to have Canadian research available. And we have production, of course, in Manitoba. It's our leading industry is drug manufacturing. I just want to say thanks to all concerned for the rain. Our fire situation, though not fully addressed, is been significantly reduced in terms of its danger as a consequence of this rain. And of course, when farmers make money, we're all better off. And this is $1 billion rain for our ag community. So I want to thank the people in charge for making that rain available. Keep up the great work. Thanks, everybody. Have a safe long weekend.
Okay, so that's a very strange thing, right? Ask a question about treatment for COVID and then thank the people in charge for rain. To summarize, we know that there are a variety of weather modification technologies that are out there and are used for potentially good purposes, but also potentially to can be used against in order to coerce, et cetera.